is out of practice and because so little remains of the material that might have been used to construct the dreams. Later he will speak of this aloud to himself, as he clutches his head and tries to pull the scattering bits of his identity closer together. And that's how I'll know what torments him. I will know that he thrashes. He dreams of two people, their features surprisingly sharp in his memory, though all else has been stripped away. Their names, their relationship to him, his reason for remembering them. He can guess, seeing that the woman of the pair has ice-white eyes rimmed with thick black eyelashes, that she is his mother. The man is more ordinary, too ordinary, carefully so, in a way that immediately stirs a suspicion in Shafa's guardian mind. Ferals work hard to seem so ordinary. How they came to produce him and how he came to leave them is lost to the earth. But their faces are interesting, at least. Of warrant and black-walled rooms carved into layered volcanic rock. Gentle hands, pitying voices. Shafa doesn't remember the hands or voices' owners. He is helped into a wire chair. No, the nodes were not the first to use these. This chair is sophisticated, automated, working smoothly even though something about it seems old to Shafa's eye. It whirs and reconfigures and turns him until he is suspended face down beneath bright artificial lights, with his face trapped between unyielding bars and the nape of his neck bared to the world. His hair is short. Behind and above him, he hears the descent of ancient mechanisms, things so esoteric and bizarre that their names and original purposes have long been lost. He remembers learning around this time that original purposes can be perverted easily. Around him he can hear the snuffling and pleading of the others brought with him to this place. Children snuffling and pleading. He is a child in this memory, he realizes. Then he hears the other children's screams, followed by and mingling into whirring, cutting sounds. There is also a low, watery hum that he will never hear again, yet it will be very familiar to you and any other origin who has ever been near an obelisk, because from this moment forth his own Sesapine will be repurposed, made sensitive to orogeny and not to the perturbations of the earth. Shafa remembers struggling, and even as a child he's stronger than most. He gets his head and upper body almost free before the machinery reaches him. This is why the first cut goes so wrong, slicing far lower on his neck than it should, and nearly killing him right there. The equipment adjusts, relentless. He feels the cold of it as the sliver of iron is inserted, feels the coldness of the other presence within him at once. Someone stitches him up. The pain is horrific, and it never really ends, though he learns to mitigate it enough to function. All those who survive the implantation do. The smiling, you see. Endorphins ease pain. Of the fulcrum, and a high-ceilinged chamber at the heart of Maine, and familiar artificial lights that march toward and around a yawning pit from whose walls grow endless slivers of iron, he and the other guardians gaze down at a small, shredded body crumpled at the bottom of the pit. Every now and again, the children find the place. Poor foolish creatures. Don't they understand? The earth is indeed evil, and it is cruel, and Shafa would protect them all from it if he could. There is a survivor, one of the children attached to Guardian Lachette. The girl cringes as Lachette approaches, but Shafa knows Lachette will let her live. Lachette has always been softer, kinder than she should be, and her children suffer for it. Of the road, and the endless flinching eyes of strangers who see his ice-white irises and unchanging smiles and know that they are seeing something wrong, even if they don't know what it is. There is a woman one night at an inn who tries to be intrigued rather than frightened. Shafa warns her, but she's insistent, and he cannot help but think of how the pleasure will keep the pain at bay for hours, perhaps the whole night. It's good to feel human for a while. But as he warned her, He circuits back in a few months. She's got a child in her belly, which she says isn't his, but he cannot permit the uncertainty. He uses the black glass poniard, which is a thing made in warrant. She was kind to him, so he targets only the child. Hopefully she'll pass its corpse and live. But she's furious, horrified, and she calls out for help and draws a knife of her own as they struggle. Never again, he resolves as he slaughters all of them. Her whole family, a dozen bystanders, half the town as they attack him en masse. Never again can he forget that he is not and never has been human. Of Lachette again. He can barely recognize her this time. Her hair has gone white and her once smooth face is all over lines and sagging skin. She's smaller, her softening bones compressing her into a hunched posture, which often happens to Arctics when they grow old. But Lachette has seen more centuries even than Shafa. Old is not supposed to mean this for them. Feebleness, senescence, shrinking. Happiness and a smile that means something other than mere mitigation of the pain. They're not supposed to have these either. He stares at her broad, welcoming smile as she hobbles toward him from the cottage to which he has tracked her. He is filled with dim horror and a burgeoning disgust that he's not even aware of until she stops before him and he reaches out to reflexively break her neck. Of the girl. The girl. One of dozens, hundreds. They blur together over the endless years, but not this one. He finds her in a barn, poor, frightened, sad thing, and she loves him instantly. He loves her too, wishes he could be kinder to her, is as gentle as he can be while he trains her to obedience with broken bones and loving threats, and chances he should not give. Has Lachette infected him with her softness? Maybe, maybe. But her face, her eyes, there's something about her. He is not surprised later when he receives word that she is involved in the raising of an obelisk in Alia. His special one. He does not believe she is dead after. Indeed, he is filled with pride as he goes to reclaim her, and as he prays to the voice in his head that she will not force him to kill her. The girl, whose face causes him to wake with a soft cry. The girl. The other two guardians look at him with the Earth's judging eyes. They are as compromised as he. More. All three of them are everything the Guardian Order has warned them against. He remembers his name, but they do not remember theirs. That's the only real difference between him and them, isn't it? Yet they seem so much less than he somehow. Irrelevant. He pushes himself up from the cot, rubs his face, and heads outside. The children's cabin. It's time to check on them, Shafa tells himself, though he makes a beeline to Nasun's cot. She's asleep as he lifts a lantern to examine her face. Yes, it has always been there in her eyes and maybe cheekbones, tickling his mind. The fragments of his memory and the solidity of her features finally coming together. His Demaya, the girl who did not die, reborn. He remembers breaking Demaya's hand and flinches with it. Why would he do such a thing? Why did he do any of the horrible things he did in those days? Lachette's neck, Temei's, Aitz's family, so many others, whole towns of them. Why? Nasun stirs in her sleep, murmuring softly. Automatically, Shafa reaches out to stroke her face, and she quiets at once. There is a dull ache in his chest that perhaps might be love. He remembers loving Lachette and Demaya and others, and yet he did such things to them. Nasun stirs a little and half wakes, blinking in the lantern light. Shafa?
It's nothing, little one, he says. I'm sorry.
Many degrees of sorry. But the fear is in him, and the dream lingers. He cannot help trying to expunge it. He finally blurts,
Nossun, are you afraid of me?
She blinks, barely lucid, and then she smiles. It untwists something within him. Never.
Never.
He swallows, his throat suddenly tight.
Good. Go back to sleep.
She drifts off at once, and perhaps she was never really awake to begin with. But he lingers near her, keeping watch until her eyelids flicker into dreaming again.
Never. Never again, he whispers,
and twitches with the memory of that, too. Then the feeling changes, and his resolve refocuses. What happened before does not matter. That was a different Shafa. He has another chance now, and if being less than himself means being less than the monster that he was, he cannot regret it. There is a quicksilver lightning strike of pain along his spine, too fast for him to smile it away. Something disagrees with his resolve. Automatically, his hand twitches toward the back of Nasun's neck, and then he stops himself. No! She is more to him than just relief from pain.
Use her, commands the voice. Break her. So willful, like her mother. Train this one to obey.
No, Shafa thinks back, and braces himself to bear the lash of retaliation. It is only pain. So Shafa tucks Nasun in and kisses her forehead and puts out the light as he leaves. He heads for the ridge that overlooks the town, and stands there for the rest of the night, grinding his teeth, and trying to forget the last of who he was, and promising himself a better future. Eventually, the other two guardians come out onto the steps of their cabin as well, but he ignores the alien pressure of their gazes against his back.
12. Nasun, falling up.
Again, much of this is speculation. You know of Nasun, and she is part of you. But you cannot be Nasun. And I think we have established by now that you do not know her as well as you think. Ah, but no parent does, with any child. Another has the task of encompassing Nasun's existence. But you love her. And that means some part of me cannot help but do the same. In love, then, we shall seek understanding.
With her consciousness anchored deep within the earth, Nasun listens.
At first, there is only the usual impingement upon the ambient Sasuna, the minute flex and contract of strata, the relatively placid churn of the old volcano beneath Jekati, the slow, unending grind of columnar basalt rising and cooling into patterns. She's gotten used to this. She likes that she can listen to this freely now whenever she wants, instead of having to wait until the dark of night, lying awake after her parents have gone to bed. Here in Found Moon, Shafa has given Nasun permission to use the crucible whenever she wants, for as long as she wants. She tries not to monopolize it, because the others need to learn too, but they do not enjoy orogeny as much as she does. Most of them seem indifferent to the power they wield, or the wonders they can explore by mastering it. A few of the others are even afraid of it, which makes no sense to Nasun. But then, it also makes no sense to her now that once she wanted to be a lorist. Now she has the freedom to be fully who and what she is, and she no longer fears that self. Now she has someone who believes in her, trusts her, fights for her, as she is. So she will be what she is. So now Nasun rides an eddy within the Jekati hotspot, balancing perfectly amid the conflicting pressures, and it does not occur to her to be afraid. She does not realize this is something a fulcrum four-ringer would struggle to do, but then she doesn't do it the way a four-ringer would, by taking hold of the motion and the heat and trying to channel both through herself. She reaches, yes, but just with her senses and not with her absorption torus.
But where a fulcrum instructor would warn that she can't affect anything like this, she follows the lesson of her own instincts, which say she can. By settling into the eddy, swirling with it, she can relax enough to winnow down through its friction and pressure to what lies beneath. The silver. This is the word she has decided to give it, after questioning Shafa and the others, and realizing they don't know what it is either. The other Origen kids can't even detect it. Aates thought he sensed something once, when she shyly asked him to concentrate on Shafa instead of the earth, because the silver is easier to see, more concentrated, more potent, more intent within people than it is in the ground. But Shafa stiffened and glared at him in the next instant, and Aates flinched and looked guiltier and more haunted than ever. So Nossin felt bad that she hurt him. She never asked him to do it again. The others, however, can't do even that much. It is the other two guardians, Nida and Umber, who help the most. This is a thing that we called for in the fulcrum when we found it, when they heard the call, when they listened too closely. Nida begins, and Nossun braces herself, because once Nida gets started, there's no telling how long she'll run on. She stops only for the other guardians. The use of sublimates in lieu of controlling structures is dangerous, determinate, a warning. Important to cultivate for research purposes, but most such children we steered into node service. Among the others, we cut them, for it was forbidden to reach for the sky. Amazingly, she shuts up after this. Nossun wonders what the sky has to do with anything, but she knows better than to ask, lest Nida get going again. But Umber, who is as slow and quiet as Nida is fast, nods.
"We allowed a few to progress," he translates. "For breeding, for curiosity, for the fulcrum's pride. No more than that."
Which tells Nossun several things, once she sifts sense from the babble. Nida and Umber and Shafa are not proper guardians anymore, though they used to be. They have given up the credo of their order, chosen to betray the old ways. So the use of the silver is clearly an issue of violent concern to ordinary guardians. But why? If only a few of the fulcrum's origins were allowed to develop the skill to progress, what was the danger if too many did it? And why do these ex-guardians, who once called for the skill, allow her to do it unfettered now? Shafa is there for this conversation, she notes, but he does not speak. He merely watches her, smiling and twitching now and again as the silver sparks and tugs within him. That's been happening to him a lot lately. Nossun isn't sure why. Nossun goes home in the evenings after her days at Found Moon. Jija has settled into his jackety house, and every time she comes back, there are new touches of hominess that she likes. Surprisingly rich blue paint on the old wooden door. Cuttings planted in the small house green, though they grow scraggly as the ash thickens in the sky overhead. A rug he has bartered a glass knife for in the small room that he designates as her own. It's not as big as the room she had back in Terimo, but it has a window that overlooks the forest around Jekedi's plateau. Beyond the forest, if the air is clear enough, she can sometimes see the coast as a distant line of white just beyond the forest's green. Beyond that is a spread of blue that fascinates her, though there's nothing to see but that slice of color from here. She has never seen the sea up close, and Aates tells her wonderful stories of it, that it smells of salt and strange life, that it washes up onto thin stuff called sand, in which little grows because of the salt, that sometimes its creatures wiggle or bubble forth like crabs or squid or sand teethers, though the lattermost are said to appear only during a season. There is the constant danger of tsunami, which is why no one lives near the sea if they can avoid it. And indeed, a few days later, after Nossun and Jija reached Jekedi, she sensed rather than saw the remnant of a big shake far to the east, well out to sea. She sensed, too,
the reverberations this caused when something vast shifted and then pounded at the land along the coast. For once, she was glad to be so far away. Still, it is nice having a home again. Life begins to feel normal for the first time in a very long while. One evening during dinner, Nasun tells her father what Aits has said about the sea. He looks skeptical, then asks where she heard these things. She tells him about Aits, and he grows very quiet. "This is a Raga boy," he says after a moment. Nasun, whose instincts have finally pinged a warning, she has gotten out of the habit of keeping vigilant for Jija's mood shifts, falls silent. But because he will get angrier if she doesn't speak, she finally nods.
"Which one?"
Nasun bites her lip. "Aits is Shafa's, though, and she knows that Shafa will allow none of his origins to come to harm. So she says, the oldest. He's tall and very black and has a long face." Jija keeps eating, but Nasun watches the flecks of muscles in his jaw that have nothing to do with chewing.
"That coaster boy. I've seen him. I don't want you talking to him anymore."
Nasun swallows and risks. "I have to talk with all of the others, Daddy. It's how we learn."
"Learn?"
Jija looks up. "It's banked, contained,
but he's furious. That boy is what, 20? 25? And he's still a Raga? Still? He should have been able to cure himself by now."
For a moment, Nasun is confused, because curing herself of orogeny is the last thing she thinks of at the end of her lessons. Well, Shafa did say that it was possible.
Ah, and Aits, who is only 18, but obviously aged up in Jija's head,
is too old to have not utilized this cure, if he's going to. With a chill, Nasun realizes Jija has begun to doubt Shafa's claims that the erasure of orogeny is possible. What will he do if he realizes Nasun no longer wants to be cured? Nothing good.
"Yes, Daddy," she says.
This mollifies him, as it usually does.
"If you have to talk to him during your lessons, fine. I don't want you making the guardians angry. But don't talk to him outside of that."
He sighs.
"I don't like that you spend so much time up there."
He grumbles on about it for the rest of the meal, but says nothing worse, so eventually Nasun relaxes. The next morning at Found Moon, she says to Shafa, "I need to learn how to hide what I am better." Shafa is carrying two satchels uphill to the Found Moon compound as she says this. They're heavy, and he's freakishly strong, but even he has to breathe hard to do this, so she does not pester him for a response while he walks. When he has reached one of the compound's tiny store shacks, he sets the satchels down and catches his breath. It's easier to keep goods up here for things like the children's meals than to go back and forth to the Jackety store caches or communal meal house.
"Are you safe?"
he asks then, quietly. This is why she loves him. She nods, biting her bottom lip, because it is wrong that she must wonder this about her own father. He looks at her for a long, hard moment, and there is a cold consideration to this look that warns her he's begun to think of a simple solution to her problem. "Don't," she blurts. He lifts an eyebrow.
"Don't?"
he challenges. Nasun has lived a year of ugliness. Shafa is at least clean and uncomplicated in his brutality. This makes it easy for her to set her jaw and lift her chin.
"Don't kill my father."
He smiles, but his eyes are still cold.
"Something causes a fear like that, Nasun. Something that has nothing to do with you, or your brother, or your mother's lies. Whatever it is has left its wound in your father. A wound that obviously has festered. He will lash out at anything that touches upon, or even near that reeking old sore. as you have seen.
She thinks of Uche and nods.
That cannot be reasoned with.
I can, she blurts. I've done it before. I know how to...
manipulate him. Those are the words for it, but she's barely 10 years old, so she actually says,
I can stop him from doing anything bad. I always have before.
Mostly. Until you fail to stop him once. That would be enough.
He eyes her.
I will kill him if he ever hurts you, Nasun. Keep that in mind, if you value your father's life more than your own. I do not.
Then he turns back to the shed to arrange the satchels, and that's the end of the conversation. Some while later, Nasun tells the others of this exchange. Little Paido suggests,
maybe you should move into Found Moon with the rest of us.
Yinegan, Shirk, and Lasher are sitting nearby, relaxing and recovering after an afternoon spent finding and pushing around the marked rocks buried beneath the crucible floor. They nod and murmur agreement with this.
It's only right, says Lasher in her haughty way. You'll never be truly one of us if you continue living down there among them.
Nasun has thought of this herself often, but...
He's my father, she says, spreading her hands.
This elicits no understanding from the others, and a few looks of pity. Many of them still bear the marks of violence inflicted by the trusted adults in their lives.
He's a still,
Shirk snaps back. And that is the end of the matter as far as most of them are concerned. Eventually, Nasun gives up on trying to convince them otherwise. These thoughts invariably begin to affect her orogeny. How can they not, when an unspoken part of her wants to please her father? It takes all of herself, and the confidence that comes of delight, to engage with the earth to her fullest. And that afternoon when she tries to touch the spinning silver threads of the hot spot, and it goes so horribly wrong that she gasps and claws her way back to awareness, only to find that she has iced all 10 rings of the crucible. Shafa puts his foot down.
You will sleep here tonight, he says,
after walking across the crusted earth to carry her back to a bench. She's too exhausted to walk. It took everything she had not to die.
Tomorrow, when you wake, I'm going with you to your house, and we'll bring back your belongings.
Don't want to,
she pants, even though she knows Shafa doesn't like it when the children say no to him.
I don't care what you want, little one. This is interfering with your training. It is why the Fulcrum took children from their families. What you do is too dangerous to allow any distractions, however beloved.
But
she does not have the strength to object more strongly. He holds her in his lap, trying to warm her up because the edge of her own torus was barely an inch from her skin. Shafa sighs. For a while he says nothing except to shout for someone to bring a blanket. Aitz is the one who delivers it, having already gone to fetch it once he saw what happened. Everyone saw what happened. It is embarrassing. As you realized back during Nasun's dangerous early childhood, she is a very, very proud girl. As Nasun finally stops shivering and feeling as though her sesapine have been methodically beaten, Shafa finally says,
You serve a higher purpose, little one. Not any single man's desire, not even mine. You are not made for such petty things.
She frowns.
What was I made for, then?
He shakes his head. The silver flashes through him, the webwork of it alive and shifting as the thing lodged in his sesapine weaves its will again, or tries to.
To remedy a great mistake. One to which I once contributed.
This is too interesting to fall asleep to, though Nasun's whole body craves it.
What was the mistake?
To enslave your kind.
When Nasun sits back to frown at him, he smiles again, but this time it is sad.
Or perhaps it is more accurate to say that we perpetrated their enslavement of themselves, under old Sansa. The fulcrum was nominally run by Origens, you see. Origens whom we had culled and cultivated, shaped and chosen carefully, so that they would obey. So that they knew their place. Given a choice between death and the barest possibility of acceptance, they were desperate, and we used that. We made them desperate.
For some reason he pauses here, sighs, takes a deep breath, lets it out, smiles. This is how Nasun knows, without cessing, that the pain which lives always in Shafa's head has begun to flare hotter again.
And my kind, guardian such as I once was, were complicit in this atrocity. You've seen how your father naps a stone, hammering at it, flaking away its weaker bits, breaking it, if it cannot bear the pressure, and starting over with another. That is what I did back then, but with children.
Nasun finds this hard to believe. Of course, Shafa is ruthless and violent, but that is to his enemies. A year calmness has taught Nasun the necessity of cruelty. But with the children of Found Moon, he is so very gentle and kind. Even me? She blurts. It is not the clearest of questions, but he understands what she means. If you had found me back then. He touches her head, smooths a hand over it, rests his fingertips against the nape of her neck. He takes nothing from her this time, but perhaps the gesture comforts him, for he looks so sad.
Even you, Nasun. I heard many children back then.
So sad. Nasun decides he would not have meant it back then, even if he'd done something bad.
It was wrong to treat your kind so, your people. What we did, making tools of you, was wrong. It is allies that we need more than ever now in these darkening days.
Nasun will do anything that Shafa asks, but allies are needed for specific tasks, and they are not the same thing as friends. The ability to distinguish this is also something the road has taught her. What do you need us as allies for? His gaze grows distant and troubled.
To repair something long broken, little one, and settle a feud whose origins lie so far in our past that most of us have forgotten how it began. Or that the feud continues.
He lifts a hand and touches the back of his head.
When I gave up my old ways, I pledged myself to the cause of helping to end it.
So that's it. I don't like that it hurts you, Nasun says, staring at that blot on the silver map of him. It's so tiny. Smaller than one of the needles her father sometimes uses to stitch up holes in clothing. Yet it is a negative space against the glimmer, perceptible in silhouette only, or by its effects rather than in itself. Like the motionless spider at a quivering dew-laden web's heart. Spiders hibernate, though, during a season, and the thing within Shafa never stops tormenting him.
Why does it hurt you if you're doing what it wants?
Shafa blinks, squeezes her gently, and smiles.
Because I will not force you to do what it wants. I present its wishes to you as a choice, and I will abide if you say no. It is less trusting of your kind. Admittedly, for good reason.
He shakes his head.
We can speak of this later. Now, let your Sesapine rest.
She subsides at once, though she had not really meant to cess him, and hadn't been really aware of doing so. Constant cessing is becoming second nature to her.
A nap will help you, I think.
So he carries her into one of the dormitory buildings,
and lays her down on an unclaimed cot. She curls up within the cocooning blanket and drifts off to the sound of his voice instructing the other children not to trouble her. And she wakes the next morning to the echo of her own screams and strangled gasps as she fights her way out of the blanket. Someone grabs her arm, and it is everything it should not be. Not now. Not on her. Not who she wants. Not tolerable. She flails toward the earth, and it is not heat or pressure that answer her call, but silver lacing light that screams in echo and reverberates with her unspoken need for force. That scream echoes across the land, not just in threads, but in waves, not just through the land, but through water and air and then, something answers her. Something in the sky. She does not mean what she does. Aates certainly does not intend what happens as a result of his attempt to wake her from the nightmare. He likes Nosun. She's a sweet kid. And even though Aates is no longer a trusting child, and it has occurred to him in the years since he left his coastal home that Shafa smiled too much that day and smelled faintly of blood, he understands what it means that Shafa is so taken with Nosun. The Guardian has been looking for something all this time, and in spite of everything, Aates loves him enough to hope that he finds it. Perhaps that will comfort you, as it will not Nosun, when in her frightened, disoriented flailing, she turns Aates to stone. This is not like the thing happening far away and underground to Alabaster. That is slower, crueler, yet much more refined. Artful. What hits Aates is a catastrophe. A hammer blow of disordered atoms, reordered at not quite random. The lattice that should naturally form dissolves into chaos. It starts on his chest when Nasun's hand tries to slap him away, and spreads in less time than it takes for the other children present to draw breath in gasps. It spreads over his skin, the brown hardening and developing an undersheen like tiger eye, then into his flesh, though no one will see the ruby inside unless they break him. Aates dies almost instantly, his heart solidifying first into a striated jewel of yellow quartz and deep garnet and white agate, with faint lacing veins of sapphire. He is a beautiful failure. It happens so fast that he has no time for fear. That may comfort Nosun later, if nothing else. But in the moment, in the pent seconds after this happens, as Nosun writhes and tries to drag her mind back from falling upward through watery blue light, and as Dishati's gasp turns into a scream which sets off others, and Peek comes forward to stare open-mouthed at the glossy, brightly colored facsimile of himself that Aates has become. A number of things happen simultaneously, elsewhere. Some of these things you will have guessed. Perhaps 100 miles away, a sapphire obelisk shimmers into solid reality for an instant, then flickers back to translucence, before ponderously beginning to drift toward Jekity. Many more miles in a different direction, somewhere deep within a magnetic vein of porphyry, a shape that is suggestive of the human form, turns, alert with new interest. Another thing happens that you may not have guessed, or perhaps you will have, because you know Jija as I do not. But in the precise moment that his daughter rips a boy's protons loose, Jija finishes his laborious climb to the plateau that houses the Found Moon compound. Too angry for courtesy after a night of seething, he shouts for his daughter. Nosun does not hear him. She is convulsing in the dormitory. Hearing the other children's screams, Jija turns toward the building. But before he can start in that direction, two of the guardians emerge from their building and move across the compound. Umber heads toward the dormitory at a brisk pace. Shafa veers off to intercept Jija. Nosun will hear of this later from the children who witness it. So will I.
My daughter didn't come home last night, Jija says as Shafa stops him in his tracks.
Jija is alarmed by the children's screams, but not by much. Whatever madness is happening within the dorm, he expects nothing better of the den of iniquity that Found Moon surely must be. As he confronts Shafa, he has a set to his jaw that you will recognize from other occasions on which he has felt himself righteous. He will therefore be unwilling to back down.
"She will be remaining here,"
Shafa says, smiling politely.
"We've found that returning to your home in the evenings is interfering with her training. Since your leg has clearly healed enough to allow you to make the climb, could you be so kind as to bring her things later today?"
"She..."
The screams get louder for a moment as Umber opens the door to go inside, but he closes it behind him and they stop. Jija frowns at this, but shakes his head in order to focus on what is important.
"She will not be rusting staying here. I don't want her spending any more time than she has to with these..."
He stops short of vulgarity.
"She isn't one of them."
Shafa tilts his head for an instant, as if he is listening to something only he can hear.
"Isn't she?"
His tone is contemplative. Jija stares at him, momentarily confused into silence. Then he curses and tries to move past Shafa. His leg has indeed mostly healed since his arrival at Jekedi, but he still limps heavily, the harpoon having torn nerves and tendons that will be slow to heal if they ever fully do. Even had Jija been able to move easily, however, he could not have evaded the hand that comes out of nowhere to cover his face. It is Shafa's big hand that splays over his face, moving so fast that it blurs before it seats itself. Jija doesn't see it till it's over his eyes and nose and mouth, picking him up bodily and slamming him to the ground on his back. As Jija lies there, blinking, he is too dazed to wonder what just happened, too stunned for pain. Then the hand pulls away, and from Jija's perspective, the guardian's face is just there, nose nearly touching Jija's own.
"Nasun does not have a father,"
Shafa says softly. Jija will remember later that Shafa smiles the whole time that he says this.
"She needs no father nor mother. She does not know this yet, though someday she will learn. Shall I teach her early how to do without you?"
And he positions two fingertips just under Jija's jaw, pressing the tender skin there with enough force that Jija instantly understands his life depends on his answer. Jija goes still for a long, pent breath. There's nothing in his head worth relating, even speculatively. He says nothing, though he makes a sound. When the children speak later of this tableau, they leave out this detail. The small, strangled whine uttered by a man who is trying not to loose his bladder and bowels, and who can think of nothing beyond imminent death. It is a mostly nasal, back-of-the-throat sound. It makes him want to cough. Shafa seems to take Jija's whine for an answer in itself. His smile widens for a moment, a real heartening smile, the kind that crinkles the corners of his eyes and makes his gums show. He is delighted that he does not have to kill Nasun's father with his bare hands. And then he very deliberately lifts the hand that had been positioned under Jija's jaw, waggling the fingers before Jija's eyes, until Jija blinks.
"There," Shafa says. "Now we may behave again like civilized people."
He straightens, head turning toward the dormitory. It is clear he has forgotten Jija already, but for an afterthought.
"Don't forget to bring her things, please."
Then he rises, steps over Jija, and heads into the dormitory. No one really cares what Jija does after that. A boy has been turned to stone, and a girl has manifested power that is strange and horrifying even for a Raga. These are the things everyone will remember about this day. Everyone, I suspect, except Jija, who quietly limps home in the aftermath.
In the dormitory, Nasun has finally managed to withdraw her awareness from the watery column of blue light that nearly consumed it. This is an amazing feat, though she does not realize it. All she knows, as she finally comes out of the fit and finds Shafa leaning over her, is that a scary thing happened, and Shafa is there to take care of her in the aftermath. She is your daughter at her core. It is not for me to judge her, but... ah, she is so very much yours.
Tell me, Shafa says.
He has sat her on the edge of her cot very close, deliberately blocking her view of Aids. Umber is ushering the other children out. Peek is weeping and hysterical. The others are silent in shock. Nasun does not notice, having her own trauma to deal with in the moment.
There was...
she begins. She's hyperventilating. Shafa cups a big hand over her nose and mouth, and after a few moments her breathing slows. Once she is closer to normal, he removes his hand and nods for her to continue.
There was a blue thing, light, and I fell up. Shafa, I fell up.
She frowns, confused by her own panic.
I had to get out of it. It hurt. It was too fast. It burned. I was so scared.
He nods as if this makes sense.
You survived, though. That's very good.
She glows with this praise, even though she has no idea what he means. He considers for a moment.
Did you sense anything else while you were connected?
She will not wonder at this word connected until much later.
There was a place, up north. Lines in the ground. All over.
She means all over the stillness. Shafa cocks his head with interest, which encourages her to keep babbling.
I could hear people talking. Where they touched the lines, there were people in the knots where the lines crossed. I couldn't figure out what anybody was saying, though.
Shafa goes very still.
People in the knots. Origins?
Yes.
It's actually hard to answer that question. The grip of those distant strangers' orogeny was strong, some stronger than Nasun herself. Yet there was a strange, almost uniform smoothness to each of these strongest ones, like running fingers over polished stone. There's no texture to catch on. Those were also the ones spread across the greatest distance, some of them even farther to the north than Terimo, all the way up near where the world has gone red and hot.
The node network, Shafa says thoughtfully. Someone is keeping some of the node maintainers alive up north. How interesting.
There's more, so Nasun has to keep babbling it out.
Closer by, there were a lot of them, us.
These felt like her fellows of Found Moon. Their orogeny bright and darting like fish, many words schooling and reverberating along the silver lines connecting them. Conversations, whispers, laughter.
A calm, her mind suggests.
A community of some sort.
A community of origins.
She does not cess, Kastrima. I know you're wondering.
How many?
Shafa's voice is very quiet. She cannot gauge such things. I just hear a lot of people talking. Like, houses full. Shafa turns away. In profile, she sees that his lips have drawn back from his teeth. It isn't a smile, for once.
The Antarctic fulcrum.
Nida, who has quietly come into the room in the meantime, says from over near the door,
they weren't purged?
Apparently not.
There is no inflection to Shafa's voice.
Only a matter of time until they discover us.
Yes.
Then Nida laughs, softly. Nasun cesses the flecks of silver threads within Shafa. Smiling eases the pain, he has said. The more a guardian is smiling, laughing, the more something is hurting them.
Unless... Nita laughs again. This time, Shafa smiles too. But he turns again to Nasun and strokes her hair back from her face.
I need you to be calm, he says.
Then he stands and moves aside so that she can see Aitz's corpse. And after she has finished screaming and weeping and shaking in Shafa's arms, Nita and Umber come over and lift Aitz's statue, carrying it away. It is obviously much heavier than Aitz ever was, but guardians are very strong. Nasun doesn't know where they take him, the beautiful seaborn boy with the sad smile and the kind eyes, and she never knows anything of his ultimate fate other than that she has killed him, which makes her a monster.
Perhaps,
Shafa tells her as she sobs these words. He holds her in his lap again, stroking her thick curls.
But you are my monster.
She is so low and horrified that this actually makes her feel better.
Stone lasts unchanging. Never alter what is written in stone.
Tablet 3, Structures, verse 1. 13. You, amid relics. It begins to feel as though you've lived in Kostrima all your life. It shouldn't. Just another calm, just another name, just another new start, or at least a partial one. It will probably end the way all the others have, but it makes a difference that here everyone knows what you are. That is the one good thing about the Fulcrum, about Mayov, about being Cyanide. You could be who you were. That's a luxury you're learning to savor anew. Your topside again, in Kostrima Over, as they've been calling it, standing on what used to be the town's token Greenland. The ground around Kostrima is alkaline and sandy. You heard Yika actually hoping for a little acid rain to make the soil better. You think the ground probably needs more organic matter for that to work, and there isn't likely to be much of that, since you saw 3 boil bug mounds on the way here. The good news is that the mounds are easy to detect, even when they're only a little higher than the ash layer that covers the ground. The insects within them tickle your awareness as a ready source of heat and pressure for your orogeny. On the walk here, you showed the children how to assess for that pent difference from the cooler, more relaxed ambient around it. The younger ones made a game of it, gasping and pointing whenever they sensed a mound and trying to outdo one another in the count. The bad news is that there are more of the boilbug mounds this week than there were last week. That's probably not a good thing, but you don't let the children see your worry. There are 17 children altogether, the bulk of Kostrima's complement of origins. A couple are in the teen range, but most are younger. One only 5. Most are orphans, or might as well be, and that does not surprise you at all. What does surprise you is that all of them must have relatively good self-control and quick wits, because otherwise they wouldn't have survived the rifting. They would have had to assess it coming in time enough to get to someplace isolated, let their instinct save them, recover, and then go someplace else before anybody started trying to figure out who was at the center of the circle of non-destruction. Most are mid-ladder mongrels like you. Lots of not-quite-sunzed bronze skin, not-quite-ashblow hair, eyes and bodies on a continuum from the Arctic to the coaster. Not much different from the kids you used to teach in Turimo's creche. Only the subject matter. And by necessity, your teaching methods must be different. Sess what I do. Just sess. Don't imitate yet, you say. And then you construct a torus around yourself. You do it several times, each time a different way. Sometimes spinning it high and tight, sometimes holding it steady, but wide enough that its edge rolls close to them. Half the children gasp and scramble away. That's exactly what they should do. Good. Not good that the rest just stood there stupidly. You'll have to work on that. Now, spread out. You there, you there. All of you,
Stay about that far apart. Once you're in place, spin a torus that looks exactly like the one I'm making now.
It isn't how the fulcrum would have taught them. There, with years of time and safe walls and comforting blue skies overhead, the teaching could be done gently, gradually, giving the children time to get over their fears or outgrow their immaturities. There's no time for gentleness in a season, though, and no room for failure within Kostrima's jagged walls. You've heard the grumbling, seen the resentful looks when you join Yuskast crews or head down to the communal bath. Yika thinks Kostrima is something special, a calm where Raga and Still can live in harmony, working together to survive. You think she's naive. These children need to be prepared for the inevitable day that Kostrima turns on them. So you demonstrate and correct their imitations with words when you can, and once with a torus inversion slap when one of the older children spins his too wide and threatens to ice one of his comrades. You cannot be careless. The boy sits on the icy ground, staring at you wide-eyed. You also made the ground heave under his feet to throw him down, and you're standing over him now, shouting, deliberately intimidating. He almost killed another child. He should be afraid.
People die when you make mistakes. Is that what you want?
A frantic head shake.
Then get up and do it again.
You flog them through the exercise until every one of them has demonstrated at least a basic ability to control the size of their torus. It feels wrong to teach them only this without any of the theory that will help them understand why and how their power works, or any of the stabilizing exercises designed to perfect the detachment of instinct from power. You must teach them in days what you mastered over years. Where you are an artist, they will be only crude imitators at best. They are subdued when you walk them back to Kostrima, and you suspect some of them hate you. Actually, you're pretty sure they hate you. But they will be more useful to Kostrima like this, and on the inevitable day that Kostrima turns on them, they'll be ready. This is a familiar series of thoughts. Once, as you trained Nossun, you told yourself that it did not matter if she hated you by the end of it. She would know your love by her own survival. That never felt right, though, did it? You were gentler with Uche for that reason, and you always meant to apologize to Nossun later when she was old enough to understand. Ah, there are so many regrets in you that they spin, heavy as compressed iron at your core.
You're right,
Alabaster says as you sit on an infirmary cot and tell him about the lesson later.
But you're also wrong.
It's later than usual for you to be visiting Alabaster, and as a result, he is restless and in visible pain amid his nest. The medications that Lerna usually gives him are wearing off. Being with him is always a competition of desires for you. You know there's not much time for him to teach you this stuff, but you also want to prolong his life, and every day that you wear him down grates on you like a glacier. Urgency and despair don't get along well. You've resolved to keep it brief this time, but he seems inclined to talk a lot today as he leans against Antimony's hand and keeps his eyes closed. You can't help thinking of this as some kind of strength-saving gesture, as if just the sight of you is a drain. Wrong, you prompt. Maybe there's a warning note in your voice. You've always been protective of your students, whoever they are.
For wasting your time, for one thing. They'll never have the precision to be more than rock pushers.
Alabaster's voice is thick with contempt. Inan was a rock pusher, you snap. A muscle flexes in his jaw, and he pauses for a moment.
So maybe it's a good thing that you're teaching them how to push rocks safely, even if you aren't doing it kindly.
Now the contempt is gone from his words. It's as close to an apology as you're probably going to get from him.
but I stand by the rest. You're wrong to teach them at all, because their lessons are getting in the way of your lessons.
What?
He makes you